بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله، نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. أما بعد، فإن أحسن الكلام كلام الله، وخير الهدى هدى محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم، وإن شر الأمور محدثاتها، وكل محدثة بدعة، وكل بدعة ضلالة، وكل ضلالة في النار. So today is lesson number 22. So 22nd lesson on the book تقريب التدمرية. And in the previous lesson, we looked at the second of the seven principles or rules that Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah discusses at the end of the section on the sifat, on the attributes. And that principle had to do with the issue of believing in whatever we have been informed about, irrespective of whether we understand the mean, or whether we understand the meaning or not. And so that principle was outlined. The Shaykh gave some reasons and explanations as to why we must believe that which we do not understand when it comes from revelation, and that's because the knowledge of Allah is complete, the ilm of Allah is complete, and Allah Azza wa Jal is the most truthful in His speech, and He's the most eloquent in His speech, and likewise the Messenger of Allah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And so we may not understand many, many things from the things that Allah has informed us about, from the unseen, about Himself, the names, the attributes, paradise, hellfire, the grave. We may not comprehend those things. And so therefore, comprehension or understanding the meaning is not a condition for having iman, having faith, belief in what Allah has informed us about. Otherwise, we would reject everything on the basis of our limited reason. So anyhow, the Shaykh explained that principle by giving examples and so on. So today we start on the third principle, or the third rule. And the Shaykh begins the chapter, فَصَلْ أَلْقَائِدَةُ الثَّالِثَ فِي إِجْرَاءِ النُّصُوصِ عَلَى ظَاهِرِهَا. And so this is to do with taking the texts upon what is apparent from them of their meaning, the apparent meaning. And this thing we spoke about maybe in some of the earlier lessons. I think this issue came up at some early point in the text. And so what this is relating to is, as we mentioned before, that in the Arabic language, as in all languages, you know, we understand what a person intends from what is apparent from his language. And I remember, I think I gave the example that if I said to you that I want you to draw me a table or a tree, you would all understand what's apparent from my speech. You want me to draw either a table like this or an actual tree, a tree with a trunk, branches, leaves, you know. And because I've not said anything else, that's what you assume to be what's apparent from my speech. Now, if I said to you, now if you drew me a tree, and I said, no, I didn't mean that. I meant a family tree, right, with a diagram and branches and this whatever. Then I wasn't really clear and eloquent in my speech if that was the case. And also I am to blame because I didn't, you know, it was within my knowledge that you would be confused, and I deliberately withheld the clarification. So this means that I didn't really intend to guide you to what is correct, right? So all of these implications arise if that was the case, right? So upon that basis, in all language, we take what is apparent of speech. It's no different in the Arabic language. And Likewise, in relation to the Qur'an has come for guidance, and the Qur'an has come in the clear Arabic tongue, in the clear Arabic language. So this is what the Shaykh is going to elaborate and explain. And obviously this is in connection to the names and attributes of Allah Azza wa Jal. And this has to be from the most clearest and apparent of affairs, where no confusion should really exist, because the intent is for us to have iman, to have belief in Allah upon knowledge, upon absolute clear, certain knowledge. So Shaykh begins by saying, ظاهر النصوص ما يتبادر منها ما يتبادر منها من المعاني بحسب ما تضاف إليه وما يحتف بها من القرائن. So the opening sentence means that what is the ظاهر, what is the apparent meaning of a text? What is that? The Shaykh says it is the meaning that immediately comes to your mind. It's whatever comes immediately to your mind in accordance with any other surrounding kind of pointers or indicators that might be attached to that speech, that's present with that speech. So don't worry if the definition isn't very clear to you, because there will be examples that the Shaykh will give that will make this clear. Right? So when we say, what is the zahir? Zahir meaning what's apparent. What is the zahir of a text? It's the meaning that becomes immediately apparent to you, that you immediately grasp and understand from speech, alongside whatever other indicators are present in the context of that speech. Right? So first the Shaykh is going to bring certain verses from the Quran before we come back to this definition, right? So he says, what is obligatory regarding these texts, the texts that relate to Allah's attributes, is that we have to take them on the basis of what is apparent from them. Right? Whatever is apparent to us, without distortion of the speech of Allah, without twisting and distorting and altering the speech of Allah, whatever is apparent of the meaning. The reason for this, the Shaykh brings a number of verses in the Quran. وَإِنَّهُ لَتَنْزِيلُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ نَزَلَ بِهِ الرُّوحُ الْأَمِينَ عَلَىٰ قَلْبِكَ لِتَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُنذِرِينَ بِلِسَانٍ عَرَبِيٍّ مُبِينٍ. Allah Azza wa Jal, he says, this, meaning the Qur'an, is a revelation from the Lord of the worlds. The trustworthy spirit, meaning Jibreel, descended with it upon your heart so that you may be from those who warn in the clear Arabic tongue. Right, so these verses in Surah Ash-Shu'ara, which is the 26th chapter, verse 192 to 195. In these series of verses, Allah informs that this is a clear Arabic Quran that has been revealed to us. He also says, "Inna ja'alnahu Qur'anan Arabiyan la'allakum ta'qilun." Indeed, we have made this to be an Arabic Quran in order that you may understand, comprehend. So the Qur'an was revealed in the Arabic tongue, in the Arabic language, in order to, so that we may comprehend the meanings that it contains. And the Arabic language is such that it can bear that whatever Allah Azza wa Jal wants to inform and convey to His servants. And the Arabic language is the language that is clear and apparent and has all of the you know, has what allows the meanings to be conveyed. That's chapter 43, verse number 3, Surah Az-Zukhruf, verse number 3. Then also the statement of Allah Azza wa Jal, اتَّبِعُوا مَا أُنزِلَ إِلَيْكُم مِّن رَبِّكُمْ وَلَا تَتَّبِعُوا مِن دُونِهِ أَوْلِيَاءَ. Follow that which has been revealed to you from your Lord, and do not follow other than him of the awliya, of the allies, and you know, so on and so forth. Surah Al-A'raf, Surah 7, verse number 3. Okay, so these ayat, what does the Shaykh intend by these verses? He intends by this small selection of verses that the Qur'an has come in the Arabic language, in the Arabic tongue. The Arabic tongue is a clear, conspicuous tongue, meaning that within the Arabic language, your ability to express very clearly and specifically what you mean, the Arabic language has that. There is i'rab, you know, there are many unique features of the Arabic language. So because of that, then it follows that this Quran has been revealed for us to grasp and understand the meanings. It has to be. And so therefore, if this is the case, then what is obligatory is that we take it upon what is immediately apparent of meaning from it. This has to be the basis. So then the Shaykh says, after mentioning these ayat, فَإِذَا كَانَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَى أَنزَلَهُ بِاللِّسَانِ الْعَرَبِي مِنْ أَجْلِ عَقْلِهِ وَفَحْمِهِ وَأَمَرَنَا بِاتِّبَاعِهِ وَجَبَ عَلَيْنَا إِجْرَاؤُهُ عَلَى ظَاهِرِهِ بِمُقْتَضَى ذَلِكَ اللِّسَانِ الْعَرَبِي إِلَّا أَن تَمْنَعَ مِنْهُ حَقِيقَةٌ شَرْعِيَّةٌ. Which means, when it is the case that Allah the Exalted has sent down this book in the Arabic tongue so that we may grasp and comprehend it, and he has commanded us to follow it thereafter, it follows therefore that it is obligatory upon us to take it upon its apparent, right? In accordance with that Arabic language. In accordance with the Arabic language. Unless there is something that prevents us from taking it upon the, you know, upon the, you know, apparent language, right? So there are some examples the Shaykh gives in his explanation to help us understand what we've gone through so far. So he says that, for example, that which is zahir, when we look at the text and we see the zahir, there are some texts which we can see they only can have one possible meaning. There's only one possible ma'na, meaning, from that text. Right? That's one situation. And sometimes what is apparent from a text, which could have one or two meanings, then the meaning which is intended becomes clear from the context. Right now the Shaykh is going to give a few examples from the Quran. The first example is there's a verse in the Quran, it's in Surah Yusuf, chapter 12, verse number 82. And in this verse, there's the statement of Allah, وَاسْأَلِ الْقَرْيَةَ الَّتِي كُنَّا فِيهَا. Right? In this verse, it is a statement, ask the town in which we were present. Ask the town in which we were present. Right? So someone is saying to someone else, ask the town in which we were present. So here, what is intended by way of Al-Qarya, which is the town? And there is no other meaning from this speech, except that it means, ask the people of the town. Right? So when you say, ask the people of the town, it's like if I say, for example, if I said, ask Oxford what it thinks of 15-minute cities. I mean, ask the people of Oxford. Because you can't ask buildings, you can't ask lampposts and pavements and roads and, you know, hills. It means the people, right? And that is clearly what is the apparent intent behind that speech. And so similarly, here when it says, وَاسْأَلِ الْقَرْيَةَ الَّتِي كُنَّا فِيهَا, it can only mean, ask the people of the city, because only the people of the city can respond. Right? And that's clearly what the mutakallim, the one who is speaking the speech, what he intends. Right? And this is what is zahir from the text, you understand? Right? This is what is apparent to us from the text. Right? This is very different, in fact, this is, let me, before we go any further, I think it might be useful. Let's finish these three examples, then I'll come back to the point I want to make, yeah? So that's the first verse in the Quran. The second verse that the Shaykh brings to illustrate the same point is the same to Allah Azza wa Jal, Surah Al-Ankabut, Surah 29, verse 31. You can check the references afterwards and look at the verses. Allah Azza wa Jal, he says, قَالُوا إِنَّا مُحْلِكُوا أَهْلِ هَذِهِ الْقَرْيَةِ. Indeed, we are going to destroy the people of this town, or this city. Right? What is intended by al-qaryah here? Indeed, we are going to destroy the inhabitants of this city. I think this is the angels who came to Ibrahim alayhi salam, and they're speaking about the city of Lut. Right? I believe that's the verse. قَالُوا إِنَّا مُهْلِكُوا أَهْلِ هَذِهِ الْقَرْيَةِ. We are going to destroy the inhabitants of this city. Here, al-qaryah, the word al-qaryah here, can only mean the buildings and the houses. Because what did he say? The people of this city. So he mentioned the people first, then he mentioned al-qaryah. He mentioned ahli hadhihi al-qaryah. Right? So clearly that can only be referring to the actual buildings and the houses that people live in. That's the meaning of qaryah in that sentence. And then, that's the second example. So we can see that the word can take on a meaning, an apparent meaning, based upon the context in which it is mentioned. And through that, the murad of the mutakallim, the intent of the one who is speaking, becomes very apparent and clear. Right? So we know what's the apparent meaning of the first text. Allah clearly means, ask the people of the city. Ask the people of the city. And in any case, the word qaryah, if you go back and look in the Arabic dictionaries and you go to the root word, the root letters, that itself can refer to either the people or the place. It can be the people or the place, right? So we know in the first ayah, the clear intent is ask the people who are in the city, not ask the city as in places. In the second example, it means clearly the houses and the abode and so on and so forth. Okay. What does this tell us is that words in the Arabic language take on a meaning based upon the context, and that entire context is what provides the meaning which is zahir, right? Now I'm going to come and give you a couple of examples to illustrate the point. So let's say we know the word lion refers to the animal lion, right? So if I said to you, you know, the lion chased the deer and killed the deer, you clearly know that I mean, from the context, that I mean a lion with, you know, the actual animal, the lion. You know that that's what I mean. But if I said to you, the lion the lion entered his castle victorious, riding on his horse. If I said to you, the lion entered his castle victorious, riding on his horse. You know here that I mean like a soldier or a king or a, you know, someone, you know, who's been in a battle, and he's referring to a man. And I use the word lion because a lion has a bravery, courage, and you know, and that's the ma'na that I'm presenting to you by giving or by making use of the word lion in this case, right? That is what you would understand to be the apparent meaning straight away from the context, yes? This is what you would immediately understand, right? What we have to distinguish is between this is how the Arabic language actually works, right? Right? And what we will learn later on is that what the people of Kalam have done, or what they do, is they've introduced some ideas and concepts about the language, about the Arabic language, the Mu'tazila specifically. They've introduced some ideas that were never known to the Arabs. They were never known to the Sahaba. They were never known to the early experts in the language, right? In the first century Hijrah, early second century Hijrah, the famous Arabic grammarians or the experts in the Arabic language, As-Sibawayh, for example, Khalil bin Ahmed, and there's others, right? It was unknown to these scholars of the language what the Mu'tazila invented and brought into the Arabic language. And so basically what they would say, they would say, I mean, I don't want to go into too much technical details, but you know the example I just gave you, I gave the example, if I said to you, the lion chased the deer, you know clearly what I mean. If I said to you, the lion is the king of the jungle, you know clearly I'm speaking only of the actual animal lion. But if I said to you that, you know, Abdullah is a lion, right? You would not understand from my speech, except that I mean that he is brave, fierce, courageous, because these are the qualities of a lion, right? A lion is brave, courageous, fierce. So when I say to you, Abdullah is a lion, right? You take my speech upon what is apparent from my speech, and you know clearly that Abdullah, who's a human, right? I'm not saying he's a lion, right? I'm saying Abdullah has the qualities of a lion. Abdullah is as if like a lion. That's what I'm saying, right? And you would clearly understand that because all speech is contextual, and it's the intent of the speaker that is what counts, right? What is my intent behind what I'm saying? And you are trying to grasp my intent, right? You're trying to grasp my intent. And so you would know what my intent is from the speech itself. Right? This is how the Arabic language basically works. And yes, a word in one place could mean one thing. A word in another place could mean something else. Right? And in both cases, it's always the zahir meaning. Right? So the zahir meaning in the first example, the king of the jungle, you know, speaking about an actual lion, right? Lion king of the jungle, right? In the second example, like I said, Abdullah is a lion. You know that I'm speaking, you know, of traits and qualities, and that would be the zahir from that, yeah? What the Mu'tazila, what they did, and this is like a mechanism that they introduced to allow them to negate Allah's attributes, right? What they said is that within the Arabic language, every word has a haqiqa, has like what they call like a literal meaning, and then it has a metaphorical meaning, an allegorical meaning, right? And then they say, they make a claim, they say, look, this is how language works. Language works where they say, for example, the Arabs, they got together and they decided that the word Asad, Asad in the Arabic language, they decided that the word Asad is going to refer to a lion. And that is the primary meaning, right? This is the first meaning. This is the first actual usage of the word Asad. Let's use that for a lion. And then they said, but a lion can also be used, the word lion can also be used as a second usage now, as a second convention, that the word lion can also represent, you know, this and this. For example, bravery, courage, or whatever it might be. This now is a secondary usage of the word lion. And then the Arabs, after making these designations, they then began to use it. And then they did the same with other words in the language, right? Think about what they are saying here, right? Is this really how language and words and their usage came to be? Is this how it happened? What's the evidence for this? Where are the reports that, you know, in, for example, you know, whenever it was, you know, let's say it's 150 AD or, you know, 300 BC, there were Arabs and they had a meeting and they got together and they decided, you know, Alif, Hamza, Sin, Dal, Asad, let's use this for the word lion. Where's the evidence? There is no evidence for this. This is just pure, this is being made up. What we know from the Quran, in fact, right at the beginning of Surah Al-Baqarah, وَعَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءِ كُلَّهَا وَعَرَضَهَا لَلْمَلَائِكَةِ, right? And then he, Allah Azza wa Jalla taught Adam all of the names. Allah taught Adam all of the names. And Ibn Abbas and Mujahid and others from the Mufassirin, from the commentators, they said, meaning that Allah taught Adam the names of all things, the name for everything, right? That's a tree, this is that, this is whatever. That's the explanation of some of the Sahaba, that he taught Adam the names of all of the things. And the angels were not taught the names of all things, right? So the names of things were taught initially to Adam alayhi salam. Then obviously thereafter, after a period of time, we know that the languages separated and became distinct, and you know, variations appeared. We know that. But there's no evidence. So language is really, it's kind of inspired and passed on, taught and passed on. No, there's no evidence that, for example, you know, some group of people decided to come together and say, well, this sound, and that sound, when we put it together in this sequence, this will refer to the lion, and this one will refer to the donkey, and this one will refer to the tree, and this is not how language works. But that's what they are claiming, right? They are saying there's a primary meaning that the Arabs agreed upon for the word Asad, and then they began to use it for the lion, and then there was other meanings that they designated, and then they began to... Why are they saying this? Why are they giving this interpretation? Right? It's because they want to introduce the concept and the idea of majaz. Majaz meaning allegory, metaphor, something being figurative, meaning that you don't really... It's not real, it's just metaphorical, it's allegorical, it's not referring to something real and true, but it's just metaphorical and allegorical. They wanted to introduce this general idea into the Arabic language to allow them thereafter to go to the verses of the names and the attributes and to say, oh no, this is just allegorical. This is not true and real. This is just an allegory. It's figurative. So, for example, They might say, you know, here in this verse it mentions the face of Allah Azza wa Jal. The face of Allah, you know, وَيَبْقَى وَجْهُ رَبِّكَ ذُو الْجَلَالِ وَالْإِكْرَامِ. The face of your Lord. They say, no, the face here doesn't mean a face. It means it's an allegory. It's metaphorical. It's figurative, right? To enable them to say that and to justify that, they entered this idea that every word has a haqiqa, or words can have a haqiqa, meaning that which is the true and real meaning or a reality, and then it also has that which is majaz, or that which is just allegory and it's figurative and it's not real and it's metaphorical and it's, you know, a figure of speech and so on and so forth, right? They put this principle in order to allow them to attack and undermine the verses of the attributes, which obviously they don't accept because of other reasons, because of other innovations that they entered into the religion, right? This is why this discussion here of language and what is the zahir, right? This is a very important discussion in the whole topic of the names and the attributes, and this is why Shaykhul Islam Ibn Taymiyyah here, rahimahullah, is obviously raising and speaking about this issue. So, as the Shaykh says, Shaykhul Ibn Taymiyyah says, إذن الكلمة بنفسها تتغير معناها بحسب السياق. Right? A word, so in the Arabic language, words take on meanings based upon the context. Right? So you need to understand the difference between how the Arabic language works and between what the Mu'tazila, what they are trying to invent and introduce in order to justify the innovation, right? How does the Arabic language work? The Arabic language works by you intend to express a meaning. So there is the murad of the mutakallim. And then you use the appropriate collection of words in a grammatical construction to convey that meaning, right? So if I want to say for example, Abdullah is fighting in a battle and he's fighting ferociously, fiercely, bravely, without any fear. And I want to express that reality, right? That now is an actual reality that is there outside of my mind. And I want to now express that. And I say, Abdullah fought like a lion. Or I might say, Abdullah is a lion. Look at Abdullah the lion. Right? So, now you don't say, so let's look at how the Arabic language, how it would work in that, and how the Mu'tazila, according to their innovation, how they would interpret this, right? So in the Arabic language, if I said, Abdullah is a lion, or Abdullah fought like a lion, right? You would say that which is zahir, from my speech, and the meaning that you immediately understand from my speech, is that I'm saying Abdullah, in his fighting, displayed the qualities which are the qualities of a lion. Right? Bravery, fierceness, ferociousness, courage, boldness. That's what you would immediately understand when I say Abdullah is a lion. Right? So this is how, in the clear Arabic language, this is what you would grasp and what you would understand. And this is what the meaning is. I am expressing a haqiqa. Do you understand? What am I alluding to with my speech? I am alluding to an actual reality out there, which is Abdullah fighting in a battle, displaying courage, bravery, fierceness, ferociousness. Right? Is my speech allegorical? Am I speaking figuratively speaking? Right. In the Arabic language, this issue would not be raised. This doesn't exist in the Arabic language. Right? Because in the Arabic language, it is the murad of the mutakallim. It's what the the intent of the speaker, what he wants to convey, and the words through which he's conveying it, this is what you would then understand to be the zahir of my speech. Right? And that's how it works in the Arabic language. Words take on sentences, are understood. The zahir is understood from a sentence based upon the siyaq, the context, and the murad of the mutakallim. So all of you, you clearly don't understand what I mean. And you know what the zahir is. You know what the zahir is. The zahir is, I'm saying, Abdullah fought with bravery, courage, and so on and so forth. And the way that I chose to convey it to you, was through the speech which I used. Right. So this is how it is in the Arabic language. And this is how it would have been known to the Arabs. However, this is a very subtle distinction as well, which is why these things are very important to understand and grasp and to know these subtle differences, especially in a topic like this. So the Mu'tazila, they come along and they say, oh, no. So when you say Abdullah is a lion, you don't literally mean he's a lion, because that's the literal meaning of the word. But what you're doing is, this is just a metaphorical, figurative use that you are making, to indicate something else. Right. There's a subtle difference between these two. Right? Because here now they've introduced the principle of haqiqa and majaz. Right? Into the interpretation and the analysis of what I am saying. Right? This did not exist with the Arabs before the Mu'tazila invented it. Didn't exist. And the Sahaba didn't know it. Right? And the Imams of the language, some of those which I mentioned, As-Sibawi, Al-Khalil bin Ahmed, there's Abu Amr ibn al-Ala, there's a few others, right? They're the masters and the experts of the Arabic language from the first century, second century. They never knew any, they didn't make this distinction. They never knew that there's somehow a word has a literal meaning and it has an allegorical. They never knew this, right? So this initial point that we are starting off with, all of this is related, the zahir of a text, right? And the meaning of a word, is there a haqiqa, is there a majaz, is there, we need to be clear about all of this, because this is one of the greatest tools and weapons of the people of Kalam in justifying their rejection of the names and of the attributes by making use of this principle, right? Allah's hand, it means power. It's allegorical, it's figurative. It doesn't mean, hand, right? And then, so we need to be clear about this issue. And so, let's hope that's clear. Anybody not clear about that? Any questions on that before I move on?
In the English language, they teach us in school about similes and metaphors and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I mean, there is in language, other languages, they have that. But the point being here is that when it comes to the Arabic language, the language in which the Quran was revealed, this notion or this idea doesn't exist. And the reason for it is because, if you got to get your mind around this, is that because language, by language, we are trying to express whatever is true and real, right? And what is true and real is either in the realm of actual things or it's in the realm of meanings, right? So coming back to that same example of Abdullah is a lion, right? When I say Abdullah is a lion, what I'm doing here is There's no metaphor or allegory or in my speech, because I am trying to convey an actual external reality by way of this speech, right? So the way you'd understand it is you'd say, okay, what is zahir, what's apparent from my speech. I'm trying to highlight and point out an actual reality that's out there, which in this case is Abdullah fighting ferociously like a lion, with bravery, with courage, right? So I'm only ever pointing out realities with my speech. Do you understand? So from that point of view, that which is like said to be majaz, like allegorical and whatever, it now becomes redundant because that division doesn't exist. And this wasn't known in the Arabic language, because the purpose of language is to convey like a meaning. And anyway, it's quite a subtle distinction, I know, but what we need to understand is that the Mu'tazila, they had numerous mechanisms that they brought in order to undermine this issue of the attributes of Allah. This is just one of them, right? This is one of them. To give you another example, would be that they say that any reports that have come by way of ahad hadith, right, which is basically one companion reports that hadith, you know, or two or whatever, it doesn't reach the level of what we call mutawatir, tawatur, where there's a large number of companions who, you know, heard something from the Messenger of Allah. Right, so any hadiths which are not mutawatir, then we cannot accept them in creed, because it's just speculation. Right? Was this known amongst the Sahaba and the Tabi'een and the Tabi'een and the Imams of hadith? Did they know this principle? Well, no. It was innovated to allow the Mu'tazila and others to reject the hadiths of the attributes that they didn't like. Right, that's another example. Right, this is another example, the majaz and the haqiqa. Right, this is in the language. This time they've come through the root of the language, the Arabic language itself. They've introduced conventions into the language that didn't exist before. Right, then they've entered into ilmul hadith, the science of a hadith, that which was not known. So the point being that there's numerous mechanisms that they use to undermine this issue of the attributes of Allah. This is just one of them. And this whole notion of like majaz and haqiqa, you know, it was unknown to the Arabs, to the Sahaba, and to the Imams of the Arabic language. So as long as we are aware of this, it doesn't matter if you fully grasp all of the subtleties and the intricacies, because I know it can be a very subtle distinction to make. But as long as you are aware of the basic facts of the matter, that this is what they are doing, this is what they intend by this division, is connected to Allah's names and attributes, it's like a play on the on language. And there's a detailed discussion on this as well. Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah actually has a whole risala on this called Al-Haqiqatu Wal-Majaz, in which he explains and gives many examples of the Quran to refute them. You know, this the topic has been explained and clarified, you know, very, very clearly and in detail. So, coming back to where we were, let's stick to some of these examples here. Right, so let's go back to... where is it? There's a statement here that he mentioned. So we said that when there is the what Allah revealed in the Arabic language, in order for us to comprehend and grasp, He ordered us to follow it, then it is obligatory upon us to treat it upon its apparent, upon the lahir, right? In accordance with what the Arabic tongue necessitates. Unless illa an tamna'a minhu haqiqatun shar'iyyah. This was the last sentence that we looked at. Unless there is a sharia reality which prevents us from taking it upon the apparent meaning. Right? Right? We're going to stay with this point and give a couple of examples to illustrate this last sentence. Okay, so in the Quran, we know that the word zakat, yes? We read the word zakat in the Quran, and we know what it means, right? Linguistically, what does it mean? It means annama, annama. Zaka means to grow. This is the linguistic meaning of the word zaka, from which zakat comes from, yeah? Nama, nama, which means growth. That's the linguistic meaning. However, the Sharia has given an additional meaning and usage to the word zakah, right? The Sharia meaning, when it's used in the Quran, is it is wealth which is obligatory to pay on certain types of wealth, specific types of wealth, right? This is the Sharia understanding of the word zakah. So someone might ask, why don't we, so in that case, why aren't we, when we read the word zakah in the Quran, why aren't we taking it upon the zahir then? Do you understand the point now? Because someone might come along and say, well, see, zakat, if it means literally growth, why don't we take the Quran upon the zahir here then? And the reason is because it is the Sharia itself that has defined and clarified the actual usage of this word. It has attached a reality to this word after the revelation of the Quran, right? So before the revelation of the Quran, zakah just means, you know, increase or whatever it might be. And that's how it was understood by the Arabs. After the revelation of the Quran has attached a reality to that word, which is what we would understand when we use that word, right? So in other words, the general principle is that we take the Quran upon what is zahir to us in the Arabic language, unless the Sharia itself has attached a reality to that particular word, right? So you can see how that is in the case of zakah. A second example here is ad-du'a, right? Oh, sorry, not ad-du'a, as-salah. As-salah. As-salah is prayer, right? And salah, or the original root, what is the meaning of that? What's the linguistic meaning? Linguistic meaning of a salah is ad-du'a. Ad-du'a. Right? This is what the original meaning of the word as-salah is. Ad-du'a. It simply means supplication. So why don't we, when we read the Quran, Allah says, you know, aqimus salah wa aqimis salah, establish the prayer. Why don't we understand the zahir as being make dua to Allah? Right? We always understand what does salah mean in the Sharia? It means that, you know, it's an act of worship which comprises of, you know, certain motions, certain statements. It starts with a takbir and it ends with a taslim. It starts with Allahu Akbar and ends with Assalamu alaikum warahmatullah. Right? This is what the meaning of salah is in the Sharia. This is because the Sharia, after the revelation of the Quran, it has attached and defined this reality of standing, sitting, bowing, prostrating, saying certain remembrances and reciting a bit of the Quran. All of that has been called the salah, right? It's the Sharia has defined the reality of that word for the purposes of the Quran, of the revelation, of the guidance of the Sharia, right? So the point being here, as the Sheikh said, is that whatever has come in the Quran, Allah revealed it for us to understand it, grasp it, and to follow it. In order for us to do that, we have to take the Quran upon what is zahir from the Quran of its meanings, in accordance with the Arabic language, right? As the Arabs would understand it in their language. Unless there is a specific Sharia reality attached to that particular word, right? So, giving you two examples: az-zakah, right, and as-salah, and you know, even like there would be many other examples. So, that clarifies to us why it allows us to answer. If someone might come and say, well, okay, like an Ash'ari or someone else might come and say, well, you know, in the Quran, Allah says, أَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ, but salah is dua. So why don't you now say, let's take it upon the zahir. And, you know, when the adhan is given, we don't need to stand and bow and prostrate. Let's just raise our hands and make dua to Allah, because that's salah. And the answer is, well, because it's the sharia itself, the Quran itself, the messenger himself, who has attached a particular reality to that specific word. And so we can only understand it in light of that. But outside of that, the general principle is that we take the Quran upon its zahir, upon the clear Arabic tongue. Right? So, so once that has become clear, then, okay, so once all of this introduction is clear, let's move to the next point, which is that the Shaykh says, وَلَا فَرْقَ فِي هَذَا بَيْنَ نُصُوصِ الصِّفَاتِ وَغَيْرِهَا. Right? So this, in this, there is no distinction between the text of the attributes and other texts. Meaning this applies to the whole of the Quran. Applies to the whole of the Quran. And the text of the attributes enter into this. Rather, the Shaykh says, بَلْ قَدْ يَكُونَ وُجُوبُ الْتِزَامِ وُجُوبُ الْتِزَامُ الظَّاهِرُ فِي نُصُوصِ الصِّفَاتِ أَوْلَى وَأَظْهَرُ لِأَنَّ مَدْلُولَهَا تَوْقِيفِ مَحْضُ لَا مَجَالِ لِلْعُقُولِ فِي تَفَاصِلِهِ. He says, rather, when it comes to the issue of the attributes, it is even more obligatory to take them upon that which is ظاهر, because the text of the attributes, the knowledge that they bring, is knowledge which can only be known by revelation. Why? Because these are from the affairs of the unseen. And, you know, there's no role for the intellect to enter into this arena of Allah's attributes. Right? So they're in the details of the attributes. So therefore, it is even more warranted and justified that when it comes to the text of the attributes, that we take them upon what is apparent from their meanings, upon what Allah intended His servants to understand from them in the clear Arabic tongue. Right? So what we'll do, inshallah, we'll stop at that point. We'll continue with this discussion, inshallah ta'ala, next week. But this is a very, very important principle to really grasp, because this is from the, you know, most frequent and the strongest types of doubts which are used by the people of bid'ah, people of innovation, in order to confuse people and to justify their rejection of the attributes. It's to do with trying to alter the Arabic language itself, the workings of the Arabic language, to introduce kind of innovated conventions into the Arabic language, you know, and it is like a quite a deep, complex issue. But inshallah, from what has been mentioned by the Shaykh, you know, it should give us like a sufficient grasp of the issue not to be confused by it, right? So we would know how to tackle this issue if someone came to us and started trying to give examples, you know, inshallah. And in the rest of this section, chapter, there are actual examples which are brought from the ahadith, from the Quran, from the ahadith, where these people use these examples to try and claim, look, this is allegorical, this is metaphorical because of this. And the Shaykh will answer those particular examples. And through that, the issue should become clear, inshallah ta'ala. So, inshallah, we'll conclude on that note for today's lesson. If there is anything that's unclear from today's lesson, feel free to ask. If something was not clear, feel free to ask. If not, then we'll close the lesson there for today, inshallah. We'll continue in the next lesson. Inshallah, we'll end the lesson there then. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala nabina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in.